I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, well, then you may not be the most likely to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. But the truth is that when many of us meet with disaster, the memories carve into our brains like a knife cut. The sounds and smells of a car accident, the expression of an attacker's face, or the sight of a loved one's dead body. A professor of psychiatry at Harvard is testing a new pill that he thinks might take away some of that horror. Now, if you could take such a pill, something that would soften the sharpness of a frightful memory, something that might prevent the onset of post-traumatic stress disorder, would you take it? Would you jump at the chance for a few days of these pills to avoid years of psychotherapy? Or like Rudyard Kipling, do you think it matters more to force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, Dr. Roger Pittman. He's a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. I enjoy your show, and it's a lot of fun to be on it.
Well, good to have you here. Let's start by talking about the study that you've been doing from the sort of practical side of it, because my eyebrows went up at the thought of you or your team of people in the emergency ward of the hospital saying to people, hey, would you like a pill? How did that come about? What were you doing there?
We were looking for people who had recently suffered a psychologically traumatic event, usually one that involved some threat to their life or to their safety. These are usually very unpleasant events that stimulate a lot of fear and helplessness in people. And just going up to them and asking them if they'll take a pill is not the easiest thing in the world to do.
No
to
kidding.
Approach people when they're in that kind of a distraught mental state and ask them. It's not simply even offering them a pill. If we're offering them a pill, it might be easier. What we have to do is ask them whether they're willing to participate in a research study.
Right.
And then they have to sign a consent form. Fortunately, I had working for me an excellent a research nurse named Anna Healy, who was very diplomatic and empathic, and who really developed a skill of being able to approach people when they're in these terrible times and discuss with them the importance of the research and elicit their confidence. That doesn't mean to say that everybody agreed. Many people refused to participate, but Anna did about the best as could be done in getting them.
You were looking for people who had recently suffered some sort of traumatic incident. Did it have to be their own incident? I mean, if you had a young man who'd been hit by a car, would you also be perhaps approaching his mother or father to say, you know, would you like to take part in this study? Because, I mean, the kind of stress on the parent in that case could be just as bad, right?
It could be. It depends really on the proximity. In case of observers, really the person would have to be right there to see it happening. In terms of a parent, it might be a telephone call from the police or from the hospital. They could also be traumatized, although the key ingredient is the ingredient of intense fear and helplessness at the time. For example, although people involved in the World Trade Center disaster who were there, who were trying to escape from the building, who were injured or attending immediately to the wounded, certainly would be at high risk for PTSD. We don't think that somebody who was living in uptown Manhattan watching on television would necessarily be. So the answer is yes, providing that there is a proximity to it. And the key thing for us is the intense fear and helplessness response.
Can we talk about just the idea of what it is that you're doing here? There is a traumatic event. A person is at risk of suffering post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that. And what is it that you want to do, or what is it that you want to find out if you can do it?
We want to find out if we can take some of the sting out of the memory of this terrible event and make it so that they're not living afterwards being haunted by the memory and having trouble focusing on what they're doing in their present life because their minds are in the past reliving this event.
And how is it then, Doctor, you would or could isolate one moment in a person's memory instead of, well, I don't exactly know the science of how the pill would work, but instead of losing an entire week or an entire month, you're just going after one memory.
We're going after something that happened relatively recently, with the typical time lapse between the event and the time we first got them to take the first medication was only 4 hours. But we're not simply trying to erase a memory. What we're trying to do is to prevent the memory becoming too strong, and so that we're not targeting the memories so much as we're targeting the over-strengthening of the memories, which we think is caused by too much adrenaline and other stress hormones at the time of the event. So really what we're trying to do with this medication, which is an anti-adrenaline medication, is to reduce the memory-enhancing effect of the adrenaline and other stress hormones.
And so if there is a memory like this existing in my brain, there's a sort of scientific spike there created by adrenaline or epinephrine or whatever those juices I produce at moments of high stress, and you're looking to kind of take the pointy edge off that?
That's right. That's a good way to put it.
What if you hit the wrong spike? What if you take away a really good memory? I don't want to be coy about this, but when you're administering a pharmaceutical to try and alter something in the brain, is there a risk of doing the wrong thing?
Well, with this medicine, there really isn't that risk. We're really not trying to take away a memory. It's
right.
Important
I keep
to understand that. What we're trying, it might be helpful to say a little bit about the animal and basic human research that led up to this.
Yeah, do that.
I bet you can remember in some detail where you were in the morning of September 11, 2001 at 9 o'clock.
Very clearly.
Most listeners, I imagine, would be able to, okay? I'll bet that you can't remember very much where you were on the morning of September 10th, 2001 at 9 o'clock, can you?
No.
So that this is what the psychologist who's done a lot of the basic research in this field has termed significance facilitates remembrance. We remember those things which are most significant to us emotionally. Let's suppose that you are a primitive Stone Age man.
Some of the people I work with would agree with that.
Right. And you're on your way to the watering hole one day and you decide to try a different route. And the route you take has a crocodile on it, and the crocodile chases you. But fortunately, you escape. Well, if you fail to remember that particular route has a crocodile on it, you're more likely to go that way again and be eliminated from the gene pool. So evolution has selected the ability for you to remember that more detail and more strongly than other things, just like you remember September 11, 2001. Well, it turns out through this basic research that Dr. McGaw and his colleague Larry Cahill and others have done, what it turns out is that the same adrenaline that's making you run as fast as you can from the crocodile is acting at the same time in your brain to strengthen the memory of this event. And this is adaptive. It's useful for us to be able to remember the things that are more significant, more intensely. But what if this adaptive mechanism goes too far, to the point where you have a traumatic event and it results in a memory that is with you all the time, that upsets you every time you think of it or every time the memory you're reminded by something, that it interferes with what you're doing, and this goes on for years and years. Then we have post-traumatic stress disorder, and then we have a situation where this normally adaptive mechanism has overshot, and now it essentially has become maladaptive, and it's produced a mental disorder. What we're trying to do with the propranolol, which is an anti-adrenaline drug.
That's the name of the drug, the propranolol.
That's right. This is an anti-adrenaline drug, and what we're trying to do is to block the over-consolidation of this memory that is induced by the epinephrine. The epinephrine and adrenaline are the same thing. This is induced by the adrenaline so that we make this a more normal memory We're not trying to take it away. We're just trying to reduce the over-consolidation, is the term I've used, that's caused by the stress hormones.
And you'll know that it's raised some ethical questions. We have with us on the line Eric Cohen. He's director of the Project on Bioethics at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I think I've got that name right. Have I, Eric?
You have indeed.
All right. And I'm not going to quote you, but I'm going to quote Leon Cass, who wrote about this in a report that you'll know, where he says, you know, distress, anxiety, and sorrow are appropriate reflections of the fragility of human life, and that such a drug could jeopardize our ability to confront with dignity imperfections and limits of our lives. Do you share that perspective of Dr. Cass?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think Dr. Pittman should, of course, be commended for his very serious work, and I think if these drugs pan out, a lot of people who are suffering will be helped. But I think it also raises a couple of very serious ethical dilemmas, one having to do with the nature of medicine and what medicine really is, and the other raising some larger questions about what human memory really is. As Dr. Pittman suggested, these drugs seem to work best if they're taken right after a traumatic event, and that's what a lot of the studies seem to have done. But what that means is that we're giving the drugs to people before we even know whether they're going to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. So what we have is a kind of preemption, which is not simply medicine. Maybe it's a kind of preventive medicine, but you're trying to cure a disease that a lot of people may not get.
Well, it's like a birth control pill, isn't it?
or a painkiller for the mind. But then the question is, well, why not? Why not just give these drugs to everybody who is a witness to a murder or is in a frightful situation? And I think the reason to be a little bit disquieted about this is that it has to do with what does it mean to remember truly. You know, to have numbed the memory of, say, September 11th is perhaps to see that event as less horrible than it really is. It is to change our identity in some way and perhaps even to compromise our shared memory as a people. So, you know, yes, of course, it would be better if the Holocaust never happened at all, but it would be also a great tragedy to not remember the Holocaust as the horrible event that it really was. And I think that's some of the worry that comes with drugs that promise to numb our most terrible memories.
And Dr. Pittman, I mean, you made the point earlier that we're all not going to take propranolol on September 12th because it was a bad day for the whole nation. You're talking about specifically targeting certain people with this, right?
Well, I think that Eric has a valid point about that. The more we can be able to predict who will get PTSD, the more we can focus the treatment. Presently, we are focusing on people who have elevated heart rates. We consider that is due to an excess of epinephrine, an excess of adrenaline.
Right.
And we know that people who have higher heart rates are more likely to go on and get PTSD. So that's one way that we can target the people who are most likely to be vulnerable. And I think with further research, I'm confident that we will develop more predictors and be more able to target the medication. But that doesn't mean it certainly will never get to the point where we can where we won't have people on the medication who, had they not taken the medication, wouldn't have gotten PTSD anyway. But that's done in medicine too. Antibiotics are given to people who, as a preventive measure, and we can't be sure that everybody who gets the antibiotic would have developed a disease
or an infection. I agree with you. And yet, Dr. Cohen, you've raised a couple of really interesting questions for us. Eric, thank you for being with us on the program.
You're very welcome.
Eric is director of the Project on Bioethics. And Connection listeners, we're talking about the nature of medicine, the nature of memory. What does it mean to remember? But think about this in personal terms for us as well. If you had a chance to take a drug like this under certain circumstances, would you? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Roger Pittman is my guest this hour. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and has been studying the biological aspects of post-traumatic stress disorder for some 20 years. We're talking this hour about some research he's doing into a drug that might in fact be used to try and soften the edge on that. And we should go back a little bit, Roger, because some of your interest in this, I gather, comes from your work with the department with veterans. Is that right?
That's right. I had a long career in the Department of Veterans Affairs, And it became apparent to me fairly early on that the number one mental disorder that the VA ought to be preoccupying itself with was post-traumatic stress disorder, because it's of all the mental disorders, it's the one which is most likely to be a consequence of combat.
But if you were to be talking to a soldier in circumstances like this, would it be, you know, someone saying, my 3 years in World War II are this great big awful part of my life, and 10 or 15 years after the fact, is that even something that falls under the umbrella of, hey, maybe we could help this with a drug like propranolol, or no?
Well, we're thinking about getting to people early on,
right,
and reducing the strength of the memories as they're being formed.
How long does it take a memory to be formed?
That's a really good question, because as long as it takes the memory to be formed is our window of opportunity within which time we have to get someone for this particular drug to be useful. In the case of the memory that's already formed and the person already has post-traumatic stress disorder, then this specific application is too late. But there are other treatments available, and there are other drugs on the horizon to assist in that.
We actually thought of a man we'd had on the program before when we started talking about the question of how and where and when you'd use this drug, particularly with reference to post-traumatic stress disorder. Steve Tice was so badly wounded in Vietnam 35 years ago in the battle for Hamburger Hill that a lot of people thought he wasn't going to make it. Since then, Steve has devoted his life to counseling other vets, and he's joining us once again on the line. Steve, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Dick. Glad to be here.
You've had a chance to listen in so far to some of this, and I know it's tweaked your curiosity, and there may be more that you want to discover about the kind of research that Dr. Pittman is doing, but what are you thinking? Would you have taken a drug like this if it was available in 69?
Well, in 1969, you have to think of the situation then. I spent a year straight in the hospital and then another year in and out, and during that time never spoke to a mental health professional. And so the atmosphere was very different now. Say if we go back to that time and the atmosphere is different, and there is a empathic nurse talking about those things, I think it is likely that many soldiers would have been interested. I know from working as a therapist for 20 years in the Veterans Administration and using a lot of Dr. Pittman's research during that time in his earlier articles, if I think of the veterans that came into say a vet center when I worked in the vet center program or when I was director of the inpatient program at American Lake, many veterans came in wanting those memories, thinking even therapy would have this magical effect to make the memory go away, like you'd reach into their brain and take it out and toss it away and life would be okay again. And I think that in the early years when I was in so much pain emotionally, that might have been something that would have been appealing. I can only think back and say, what would I have done at the worst moments? And certainly if somebody had offered me a pill, I think I would have taken it.
Yeah, I don't want to be too Boy Scout about this, but, I mean, in many ways, everything that you have done in your adult life is also as a result of your injury. Your quality as a counselor is linked almost inseparably with what you suffered there. So just if we turn it around and look at it from the perspective that Eric Cohen presented a few moments ago, is there also a case to be made that the memory, whatever it is, however awful it is, may be better left alone?
Well, and in that case, and I would say, and as I look at my life and as I thought about this and read an article about propranolol and thought about myself, I know that the traumatic injury that I incurred in the field and what I saw and what I went through has informed my life, and it has created a person with much compassion and patience and interest and ability to be with people who have suffered from traumatic experiences and be able to be there in the moment with them in ways that I could have never been. And it has also helped me see a larger world picture and work in the community and in the world for peace. And my traumatic injury has informed my life, yes.
May I just interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
Steve, I'm so glad to have you on the program, and my research was inspired by guys like you who served in Vietnam. I just want to say, Dick, that certainly up to a point, one's life can be broadened and one's appreciation for life can be enhanced by having experienced traumatic events and survive them. But I think we need to recognize that the people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder have gone beyond that point. They are not.
This is not character building we're talking about.
Well, it's in a way it's character destroying. For example, they're so preoccupied with what happened to them, they can't think about much else, and they really can't focus on what's going on. And they also have a great deal of trouble making relationships with family members, with friends, because their emotions are not just free to get engaged in the present. They're just too tied up in the past. Oftentimes, they become quite isolated, irritable. Their family relationships suffer. So if you were to listen to the stories of some of the people with more post-traumatic stress disorder, you would not come out with the impression that their lives have been enhanced by their traumatic events, I can assure you.
And what Roger's saying describes your situation very clearly, Steve.
Oh, I've talked to many veterans who, if they were at an early stage or even a chronic stage of PTSD, and I suggested to them, "Oh, you can be just like me, and your life could be enhanced." They would think it was trite, and
I don't think we could use those words on the radio. What they would say to you?
Yeah, well, and even myself, had somebody come to me in 1969 in my hospital bed and said, "This is going to inform your life, and you're going to do something like that I've done with my life," I would have probably used some off-color language.
But that does seem to have panned out for you in the long run. But I also would just like to make the point that for people less fortunate than you, it never happens. Their lives are never enhanced by the trauma. Their lives are more likely to be destroyed by it, and their relationships with other people are more likely to be harmed. And those are the people that we would like to have an impact on.
I've seen people who have including myself, my early years of trying to deal with the planet after being badly wounded in Vietnam was not successful, and it was through therapy that I began to see things different. And so I'm more in line with seeing us as therapists and researchers and all to work all together. There is no cookie cutter answer to the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, and utilizing medication, therapy, spiritual intervention, whatever we need to help a diverse population. And as Dr. Pittman presents, this medicine is not for everyone.
Steve, I want to thank you for being with us on the program again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I just want to say one other thing. Dr. Pittman's work with post-traumatic stress disorder and wounded Vietnam veterans helped me personally as well as professionally, and I thank you.
Thank you for saying that, Steve.
That was nice. Steve Tice, former director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Treatment Program at the American Lake VAMC. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Sumter, South Carolina. Ron is with us. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is quite a sort of a comment and opinion. I can't speak to the extent to which an individual would be bothered by post-traumatic stress, because I've never experienced stress to the extent of a soldier in a war situation.
Right.
But it seems to me that it's a shortcut with where you're sedating instead of treating. I don't know what I would do given the same if I was in that situation and I was experiencing that. But it just seems to me that it would always be better to make whatever attempts possible to treat a person through therapy over in a clinical setting over a period of time.
I think this is different from sedating somebody. And my understanding is limited. Roger, help me with this.
Well, the propranolol isn't really a sedative. What it really does is to neutralize the effects on the brain of the adrenaline that's been mobilized by the traumatic event. I think it's also important to keep in mind the chronology here. The treatment would come after a person had already developed PTSD. So it's not an either-or situation. It's conceivable that we could give people propranolol or other drugs in the future that may even turn out to be more effective to try to prevent the PTSD from occurring or at least to reduce its intensity. But then if it doesn't work and their people are still left with PTSD and troubling memories, they could also be involved in treatment as well to try to improve that situation.
How far along are you? I mean, is this still at such an early stage that you're trying to figure out whether or not a drug like this could work, or are you at a testing stage where you're wondering how it might in fact be administered to people?
About halfway between. We did a pilot study of 41 patients who came to the emergency room at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and the results were promising, but they weren't definitive. Another group in France did a similar study of people who came to French emergency rooms, and they also found positive results.
And there's something going on at in San Diego as well?
Well, there's a doctor named Murray Steen who is presently doing a study of propranolol and another drug called gabapentin, but he doesn't know the results yet. We're at the stage where we have a good lead, which shows promise, but it's not conclusive yet. That's why we recently got an additional grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to study a much larger number of subjects over the next 4 years.
So an appropriate time to talk about whether or not it's the sort of thing that people would be interested in, looking back at your own life experience or imagining this for others. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Randolph, Massachusetts, and Bridget's on the line. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
My concern is the idea of consequences in life, and that life isn't easy. It's painful and beautiful all at once. And we, with this drug, it seems that it's going to attempt to lessen the consequences of the painful parts of life. However, with that goes, I think, maybe a less aware position on how to attempt to have an impact on, I guess, I think about on the, it's bothering me, an impact, learning how to have an impact on the problems that cause people to go out and, say, attack or need to have war and things of that nature. It seems like we're more focused on the symptoms and the leftovers of it versus being aware of that we have to value every human.
Are you suggesting, Bridget, that maybe the drug could be taken by the people who are doing the attack, and that's what's troubling you, that it's a way of that someone would use it to desensitize themselves?
I think both. I see it as both. Like, I can see sort of a criminal mind going something to the effect of, "What? Hey, they have the pill. Who gives a fuck?"
Well, I think you've expressed your point of view, but we'll try and stay away from that kind of language. Apologies to our listeners. Roger.
Couple things. Let's take
the first part. Whether or not somebody could get their hands on the medication and use it to make themselves some kind of Terminator character, where nothing really affects them.
Okay. I think that the analogous argument is with the use of morphine or opiates, narcotics for pain. We certainly know that they can be a godsend to people who have terminal cancer and who are in intense pain. We also know that they're capable of being abused if they're taken by the wrong people in the wrong circumstances. I don't think the fact that they're capable of being abused would, at least I hope it wouldn't, lead us to the point where we're going to abolish them completely and deprive people who are suffering from severe physical pain from cancer or other medical conditions, deprive them of the access to it because under other circumstances they could abuse. I think it's a very analogous situation with regard to post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a mental pain which also has a physical basis in the brain.
And Do you know enough about propranolol now to imagine that if it were handed out as a preventative medication, which it seems quite clearly it would have to be, that, say, you and I have a car accident. Maybe you aren't going to experience post-traumatic stress disorder, and I am, but we both take the pill. Is there a downside for people who are maybe just at risk, take the pill, but would never have got into sort of post-traumatic stress disorder? I mean, is it a little bit like taking a low-grade aspirin to prevent heart attacks, or would there be a risk at giving it to somebody at that moment of stress?
In the individual case, I don't think it would be much of a risk for someone who wasn't going to get PTSD anyway to have taken the medication. The drug is quite safe, and I don't really see much risk there in the individual case. The only risk that one I could really imagine is the kind of risk that bioethicists are talking about, which is that that person might be deprived of some kind of life-enhancing or learning experience of having been in the accident. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't discount that possibility, and I think it's important to consider it, but it's pretty speculative. And I think it would be a real mistake to derail a promising research for creating a real tangible benefit for people in terms of preventing PTSD out of speculation about what the consequences on that broader scale might be.
And when you are testing people to find out if the drug had any effect, I understand that you play back to them the sound of their own voice describing the event on the day that it happened. Why would you do that? How does that work in the test?
That's how we got started doing our research into post-traumatic stress disorder way back about 20 years ago when PTSD had just been made an official diagnosis. There was a lot of skepticism about whether it's really a mental disorder or whether it was just some kind of a political concession to the Vietnam vets who were looking for compensation. So we decided to set out to see if we could develop some objective markers of PTSD, not simply based upon what people told you, but some way of measuring it biologically. And along with my colleague, Dr. Scott Orr, who's a psychophysiologist, we used a technique called script-driven imagery, where we asked, it was initially with veterans, we asked them to describe their traumatic combat event, and then we made a tape recording in their own words of the event. As if it was, and then we played it to them in the laboratory and asked them to remember it for a brief period of time as if it was actually happening again.
So then you're measuring heartbeat, sweating, those kinds of
muscle tension, that's right. While they were doing that, we were measuring their physiologic responses. And what we found was that the ones who had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder had much larger physiologic responses when they remembered their events than the ones who didn't have PTSD. So
I want to stop you there. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation as we talk about new research into a pill that's designed to take some of the edge off what could be post-traumatic stress disorder. What do you think of that? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Dr. Roger Pittman, psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, studying the biological aspects of post-traumatic stress disorder for 20 years, now experimenting with a pill which could be given to people after a moment of trauma and might do something to soften the edges of that. We'd like to have you join our conversation about that. We're at 1-800-423-TALK, and we'll take our next call from Watertown, Massachusetts. Rebecca's on the line. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello. 20 years ago, I was asleep in my apartment, and a man broke in and held me at knife point and raped me. I was in a deep sleep at the time. And for about 6 months after that, it was impossible for me to sleep because the adrenaline rush would come just as I was falling asleep. And it was absolute hell. I couldn't sleep. I was having memories. And frankly, any pill that would have stopped that adrenaline at that time, I would have considered a gift from God.
How are you doing now?
Oh, well, after years of therapy and a long time, I'm pretty much over it, yeah. But I remember that time, and it was just pure unmitigated hell. There's no two ways about it.
Rebecca, do you remember in the days afterwards, one of the things we were talking about earlier in the program is the how big the window is for the memory to form from that. I'm wondering if you heard that part of the program and if you've got some insight there.
Well, I know that for the next 5 to 6 years, there were certain things that would trigger it. If I smelled things, if I saw things, any loud noise, I still have a very strong startle response. I think anything that could have dampened that in the first couple of days, because those first couple of days, I was in a fetal position in the corner of the room, reliving it over and over and over again.
Wow. The way that a drug like this could be used in the case of someone like Rebecca. So, Rebecca, don't go anywhere. Just hang with me for a second here. But I want to hear Dr. Pittman on this being a case where within those 2 days, 3 days, within that first week, or really only like in the hours afterwards.
Well, let me just say two things. First of all, I think that Rebecca's story very nicely illustrates how serious a condition this is, post-traumatic stress disorder, that it is more than people just being a little bit upset, that it really can be very derailing of one's joy in life and even of one's functioning. But Rebecca also raised an interesting scientific question, which is that she said that in addition to the adrenaline rush that she must have felt at the time that this trauma was occurring, she also experienced continuing adrenaline rush as she remembered it. And it's possible that these continuing adrenaline rushes afterwards are even burning the memory of this event into her brain even further, and so that there may be a process whereby people re-traumatize themselves when they remember about it, that propranolol could also interfere with. Now, if that were the case, then the window of opportunity for changing things could lengthen out over a matter of days or weeks, not just a few hours.
And Rebecca, you'll know from an earlier part in the program that we keep coming back to this sort of, yes, but aren't these sort of character-building or transformative experiences, and is there a risk in using drugs or chemicals to take that away? I would imagine you'd have a fairly blunt answer to that speculation.
Well, when I first started listening to the program, I kind of thought, well, would I? And then when I heard that it would take away the adrenaline, it was absolutely yes, because there was enough going on. I'm not going to say I didn't learn something, but, you know, there are some things you don't need to learn.
Yeah.
You don't need to learn what it's like to be terrified for your life. You don't need to learn what it's like to wake up every night with your heart pounding because you don't know if someone's going to come and kill you. You can live without those things, you know, because you cannot integrate evil in your life. And you cannot integrate evil, I think, psychologically. And that being the case, yes, you will learn something, and it may or may not be character enhancing, but a lot of this, all you can do is hope that it fades away.
It just puts the case pretty powerfully.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Rebecca, I want to thank you for calling. It's nice to have you on the program.
I think it's also worth emphasizing that we're not trying with this medication to completely obliterate any emotional reaction that people are going to have to life events. That, first of all, that's not even within our power to do so. What we're trying to do with the drug is to take away some of the excess, bring it back down more towards a normal memory. If we had given Rebecca this drug, it wouldn't have made her have amnesia for this event. She still would have known what happened to her. She still would have emotion when she remembered it, and she still may have been able to learn from it. But what we would like to have done is to take away some of the reliving and the intense emotional arousal and upset that she continued to experience for many months.
1-800-423-8255. Next call from Marblehead, Massachusetts. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm a sufferer of PTSD, and it's had a significant impact on my quality of life, and so you'd think I'd be very enthusiastic about the prospects of a pill like this preventing the 20-some years of difficulty that I've had, but I'm very concerned with the kind of ethical rationales that the researcher is presenting, comparing this to morphine and
David, back up a little bit. What happened to you? What kind of post-traumatic stress disorder are we talking about here? Just so you know.
I was in the Israeli Special Forces and was involved in incidents that imprinted themselves pretty deeply on my mind. It actually took many years before they bubbled up, and from that point onward, every dream I have every night has to do with those events.
And I'm interested, David, when you reflect on your own experience, I gather what you're saying is you'd sooner live with those dreams than wind the clock back and imagine the prospect of somehow taking some of that away?
I would rather see a focus on treating the after effects of post-traumatic stress syndrome than obliterating the impact of the memories. Part of my work to help bring peace in the world and prevent war and violence is informed by those experiences. And, when I think of a pill like this and I hear the rationalization about morphine, To me, this is more like a handgun. Now, you can say guns can be useful for all sorts of purposes. They're fun for target practice. But a handgun is pretty much good for nothing except shooting other people. And in all the possible ways to treat post-traumatic syndrome, the idea of weakening the memory imprinting of the horrific event disturbs me, and it disturbs me for a specific reason. I heard the rape victim speak earlier, and I sympathize, and that's the kind of circumstance where a pill like this would be wonderful. But there's only one circumstance in human experience where we know in advance that we're going to subject people to traumatic experiences, and that's when we send soldiers into war. And this kind of pill, I'd be surprised if there isn't funding for this from the Pentagon, because this kind of pill is tailor-made for, you know, a general's dream of sending people in, having them experience the horrors of war, and then never coming back and forming, you know, veterans against war or informing the public about the horrors that they witnessed.
David, let's hear from Roger Pittman here.
Really, there is not funding from the Pentagon. We tried to get money from the Pentagon, but they didn't give it to us. They said they had higher priorities. We wound up getting the money from the National Institute of Mental Health. I think the kind of nefarious motivation that the caller is attributing to the military is something that I've never seen, even though I was on active duty in the Navy and I've had dealings with the military over the issue of PTSD for many years. I think it's a far-fetched scenario. I'm not saying we shouldn't be thinking about it. I'm not saying we shouldn't be aware of these possibilities, but I certainly would oppose efforts to prevent our finding out, in fact, what this drug is capable of doing on the basis that it might, in some people's speculations, have these negative effects.
But the bigger part of where David's going with this, I think, is that, you know, if you mess with memory even a little bit, are you also messing with history a little bit, or the way people remember it or relive it or are themselves changed by that?
Sure, you are messing with history. Just like when you prevent smallpox or stamp out polio, you're messing with history also. I want to just go back to one other thing with regard to this listener's comments, and that is that application of propranolol, it's called a secondary prevention. That means that the event that causes potentially causes PTSD has already occurred, and that we're trying to prevent it from leading to the PTSD in the person who experienced it. I certainly agree with the implications of the listener that the best way to prevent PTSD is primary prevention, which would be to prevent traumatic events from occurring in the first place, so that those of us who are concerned about the bad consequences of PTSD would absolutely favor any efforts to prevent war to begin with. And it certainly would be a nightmarish scenario if the availability of this drug were to make it more likely for wars to happen because generals or politicians can say, oh, well, we can always wipe out the memory of it anyway. Those of us, anyone involved in PTSD, would oppose to any kind of thinking along those lines and would favor, above all, more than the propranolol or more than treatment for PTSD, preventing traumatic events in the first place.
It's interesting the way that I misinterpreted it at the beginning and you corrected me, and yet people keep coming back to this notion of wiping out the memory, that's how people tend to hear what this drug might do. Let's say that I was in a bloody awful car crash, and it was one of those memories that you know might come back to me. Do you have a way of describing for me how that memory might exist in my mind if I'd taken a drug? Because you're saying the memory doesn't go away; it's just somehow altered. And I don't know if you can describe how it's altered.
I think that let's say you're a person who would have gotten PTSD but for having taken this drug, and now you take the drug. I think your memory would be more like the memory of the event of someone who didn't have PTSD. Someone in an awful car crash who's fortunate enough not to get PTSD doesn't have amnesia for the car crash. You can't say that they haven't learned from the experience. They can remember it. They can tell you about it. They may well have learned from it.
And doesn't have a problem getting back in the car, doesn't break into a sweat.
Right, but they don't have PTSD. What we would like to do is to normalize the memory so that the ones who otherwise would have gotten PTSD can wind up in the same place as the people who experienced the event but were fortunate enough not to get PTSD.
Isn't it interesting, though, when you start talking about memory, how powerfully people react? You know, when we were talking about having you come on the program, all the producers and myself, we were sitting in the office and talking about, you know, moments of great embarrassment or moments of great trauma, you know, and imagining how those might be altered. It's like memory is something so precious or so powerful that people have a lot bundled up with that. Do you agree with me?
Well, I think that memory is, you know, central to human, to what it is to be human. That's what the President's Commission on Bioethics said, and I agree with them. I don't really have any, I only have one bone of contention with the President's Commission on Bioethics, which was reflected in your first caller. I certainly think we should be aware of the potential downside of this, and we need to be careful in how it is used. The one area I disagree with is the idea that because it could potentially, based upon speculation, have these negative effects, we shouldn't be looking into the possibility of it being beneficial for PTSD at all. I don't think it would be fair to the veterans or to the rape victims or to the accident victims who are going to go on and suffer the kind of symptoms and distress that the one caller who had been raped experienced. I don't think it would be fair to deprive them of the opportunity of getting benefit out of the drug like this based upon the speculation that it might have negative consequences for society. And first of all, we don't know whether there are going to be those negative consequences. And the only way I know of finding out is to apply the scientific method and to study it and see what the consequences are.
Roger, I want to thank you for coming in, being part of the program today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Roger Pittman is a psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Earlier in the program, we talked with Eric Cohen, director of the Project on Bioethics at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Steve Tice, former director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Treatment Program at the American Lake VAMC. Just a reminder that there's going to be a feature article this weekend in the Sunday New York Times Magazine, specifically about Dr. Pittman and the work that he's been doing. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.